You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. And we are on location at the Slam Dance Film Festival headquarters on historic Main Street in Park City. I'm your host, John Wildman, and joining me this morning at Slam Dance and Sundance are my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And today on this segment, we're going to be doing a little women's roundtable, and I luckily pulled the long straw, so I get to talk with these women. We have from the Naples International Film Festival the director of that festival, Shannon Franklin.
Hi, John.
We have from the Oxford Film Festival in Mississippi, we have the executive director, Melanie Addington.
Hi, wild man.
And we have from Talking Pictures, film critic Emily Clark.
Hi, John.
All right. I'm excited to start this one off with a picture that Melanie Addington posted. And it was a panel.
I knew it.
It was a panel on the future of film distribution, women being the future of film distribution. And weirdly, on this panel, it was two white dudes and one woman. So, Melanie, you posted this on Facebook, got a lot of reaction out of it, as you should.
Yes.
As we should. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So they did ask for that panel to be off the record, but not visually. So I won't say who was on it, but it was three distributors. And they talked at length about how, you know, there are no initiatives. They are not trying to focus on parity. But yeah, there's some good female filmmakers out there. But if festivals would just, you know, have more women directors, then they could find more films. Mm. A lot of eye rolls in the audience.
Yeah, a lot of eye rolls. And you are two programmers, Shannon and Melanie. And so you are dealing with film distributors. You're dealing with people that you're trying to get movies from and people that are trying to get movies to you. And let's talk about that disparity that you see and that you have seen, because you both of you have been working with both of these festivals for a little while. Not just in a year
forever.
Or two.
Yeah, forever and right? A day.
But talk about the conscious aspect of that.
Yeah, and by the way, I want to say I know that this particular segment here, I thought it was, you know, you had it as, you know, a female round table, and I was shocked to find three women in the room that you're going to talk to, so I'm a little confused, Yeah, I think that, I mean, I know for me, and this is my 12th year program for the Naples International Film Festival, you really have to dig deep to try to find parity, I think, when you're really looking to give the equality in the voices, and it just doesn't always show up organically. That doesn't mean that we should negate the awesome storytelling that's coming from men. We want to not have the pendulum swing so far the other way.
And our non-binary friends.
Absolutely, please, absolutely. Everyone being equally represented, and of course there's also the artwork that matches your programming, what you're looking for. But I think at this stage, I know that I have to go above and beyond to really stretch to make sure that I'm creating those opportunities for consideration so that we can bring a balanced program to our community.
Emily, I wanted to bring you in on this. And,
sure.
And this is a different topic within this. And this is about award season. And a lot of conversation, a lot of stuff has been written about the lack of nominations for female directors. And one writer who I respect a lot, Sasha Stone at Awards Daily, I believe she writes for now, she has written a lot and very enthusiastically about the fact that, in her opinion, there's a reason there are no nominations, because none of the filmmakers deserve them.
And,
in particular, not a fan of Greta Gerwig's Little Women.
Such
which
an
a lot
incredible
of people,
film.
Well, you know, not according to Sasha.
But there were other filmmakers.
There were other filmmakers. I mean, The Farewell was one of my favorites.
I love The Farewell. Right? I got to see that here last year. Just incredible.
You know, it's amazing. Neighborhood. You know, Marielle Heller is another favorite of mine. But again, you're a film critic, and you're looking, you're surveying what's out there. Her argument has been that the argument put out there that basically women deserved a nomination this year, she said that was a wrong argument, that she thought that was damaging because it wasn't based on, you know, it was like there was an entitlement of, well, what's our, which one is our slot? And her basic
women
argument boiled down to, women don't necessarily get a slot if their film isn't as good. But I want to sit back and listen to you talk about this.
So I'm trying to understand, you know, this concept of excluding women from the conversation. I mean, film is an incredibly powerful way that we can communicate nowadays, and especially with Sundance, it's one of the things that I really admire about the festival, is that these conversations can happen just like back in the day when we had kind of like the old fashioned, you know, sitting around the dining room table talking about political issues and relationships and these kinds of things, those kind of conversations. I think Sundance does a really good job of bringing those back into the foray. And then just in terms of like awards season, everything, I think, you know, it's just, it's a larger conversation, but I think as 2020 gets started and everything, I, for example, like today I'm going to see several films that were directed by women and starring powerful, amazing female actors. So, you know, I think it's kind of, not that I would dismiss what this woman is saying. I have a hard time understanding what her argument is.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Well, you know, and you know, for my website for Films Gone Wild, I know that I like the idea of that page representing everybody. And so I'm so right. that's in my mind as I'm which films we're featuring, which films, you know, we're doing reviews of, which are, because you know, I am conscious of that. I'm curious, you know, from your standpoint, like when, as you're choosing films to watch and films to review,
sure,
and which films, you know, are getting that, or, you know, do you have that in your mind where you're going, you know, something? If I'm looking at the page, we've got a few dudes here, you know, what, you know, how can we balance this out?
I wouldn't say that I do that. I mean, I certainly am more drawn to female-driven films and narratives because it's so important. It's so crucial to today's world.
So, and it is organic.
It is organic for me. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I am the opposite. I feel like we're the gatekeepers. We're curating these films. We're saying this is what matters. And if distributors and festival programmers aren't saying this is what matters, we're showing all voices, then nobody's going to get it. We're going to have those perpetual voices saying, well, you know, it should just be if they deserve it. And that's not the case. It's because it is a self-perpetuating system of who votes is former winners, which are mostly white men.
Right. And which you segued into the last segment, that part of this that I wanted to talk about, which was the 50-50 by 2020 thing. And a number of the film festivals on the regional circuit have adopted this. Shannon, Melanie, you want to describe what the 50-50 by 2020 pledge process is?
Yeah, I believe Women in Hollywood led the charge on this, and it was by this year's festivals to actually have parity. And on my first announcement, I was two films away, but I think I've secured a couple of films, so we'll actually have parity now, so I'm really excited.
Awesome.
But, you know, we've been really focusing on this anyway, and there are festivals that were already doing it well before this. Kukulors has had parity for, like, 10 years already. Like, there's a lot of regional film festivals already making this a mission. Mm-hmm. They're just not getting the recognition that the big fests are.
And Shannon, let's talk about from the programming angle, as you're looking at films, as you're circling which films you're going to try to check mm-hmm. out here, and you're also looking at your grid as you're, you know, programming, you know, what is in your head with that process in relation to this?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it starts organic. I'm looking for the things that inspire me, and I just, you know, I want to be moved by the subject and the stories that are being told. And then as we get a little closer to fine-tuning a final program, I will look, and I will be thoughtful. And I also want to be, you know, really mindful that I don't want it to ever occur like somebody is getting a spot or I'm considering something that is not, you know, a great piece of art that doesn't make sense just because they're X. I feel like that also has its own disservice to the you know, the community. And I think it goes back to, honestly, what we're all talking about is inspiring and encouraging all people from all backgrounds, regardless of how they identify, to get into this field, to explore their art. And the more people who get into it and feel like there's no barrier to your creativity, the more the projects will have a diverse look and feel. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll just make it easier for organically for us to have this great pool of films and art for all of us to share in.
Yes, but we have to also open that door. Mm-hmm. And I think being a film critic, we need more diverse voices from the critic perspective instead of primarily white men.
Well, so bylines as well as the films themselves.
That's like yesterday, I'm writing for Hammer to Nail, and I was the only disabled writer writing about Crip Camp. And everyone else was saying, how inspirational. And I was saying, here's the things that worked, and here's how much more we have to come. And everyone was like, oh my God, I appreciate that you had a voice in this. Wow.
Absolutely. Well, again, we've been talking about, and I love that we were able to cram like three or four issues along this, these subjects. We begin talking with Melanie Addington. She's the executive director of the Oxford Film Festival. Shannon Franklin, who's the director of the Naples International Film Festival down in Florida. And Emily Clark from Talking Pictures. It's been great to have you all here.
Thank you so much.
John.
The Festival Daily Buzz would like to thank the following businesses for their support. Ketos Brewing, Pro Bar, The Market in Park City, and The Social Study in San Francisco.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, here working with my Bitch Talk co-host, Angela Tabora. And this segment, we're going to be talking about Epicentro. And we've got the director, Hubert Salper, here. And this film is playing in the World Cinema Documentary Competition at Sundance. And Hubert, we'd like to start this by letting our filmmaker have the first shot at describing the movie. So tell us about your film.
You start with a simple question. All right. Thanks for having me, John and Angela. Well, Epicenter is describing a place. It's essentially physically and metaphorically the port of Havana or Cuba. And the movie is about nothing more and nothing less than the birth of the American Empire. And the American Empire was born during one night in the port of Havana when the USS Maine exploded. It was a US ship. Nobody knows until this day why it blew up, but that was kicking in the what then was called the Spanish-American War, which was also de facto the end of the Spanish Empire and the beginning of the American Empire. So that is just the grit. The Epicentro is a film that's shot in Cuba today, and it is told essentially by young prophets, by children who are between 10 and 12, who live in the old town of Havana, and who are not explaining, but who are giving us an experience and who make us understand the genesis of the American Empire. That sounds very weird, but that is the starting point of the film.
Well, what I thought was wonderful about the film is that you have these two elements that on the face of them you would think maybe two disparate elements, and one is kind of giving us just an overall flavor of Cuba and a wonderful experiential moment in there, and the other is the children and how they are our guides through which is of course a famous thing now, fake news, with the story has been, and I just enjoyed the heck out of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, fake news is of course a contaminated term, as we all know. The truth is that to come back to Epicentro, one of the plots of the film is also that when the USS Maine exploded 120 years ago, that was for the War Hawks, for then would be President Teddy Roosevelt, for example. I'm sorry, a lot of people love him in this country, but I call him a War Hawk still. They wanted to kick out the Europeans. Essentially, the Spaniards were the last power in the Caribbean, and America was ready for America for the Americans, and the problem was public opinion. Public opinion in the States only 30 years after the Civil War was not ready to send the children overseas to die in the Philippines. Where are the Philippines anyway? Where's Cuba? I mean, so people were essentially in a large extent very anti imperialistic and anti-interventionist and anti-colonial, so to say, in America, because America was also, you know, victim of European colonialism. So the public opinion was not ready. The Maine exploded. Now, what was triggering the Spanish-American War were two factors, among probably others, but that's kind of my theory, which is depicted in the film, which was yellow press, a new kind of press. It was a sensational press that was villainizing the Spaniards, kind of, you know, William Hearst cry for war. And there was a new invention in favor of the war that was a technology that was hypnotizing millions of people in favor of the war. This technology, this witchcraft, was called cinema. It sounds very weird, but the first time Americans have ever seen moving images was the Maine is exploding, battleships blowing up, executions of the evil Spaniards against the poor Cubans. And it turned out later that that was essentially fake news. I mean, the ships that blew up were filmed models in a bathtub in
which is a remarkable thing. They were doing what we still do today as far as filming models and the shots of the guy of the people using the cigar smoke to make it look like explosions. Yeah. And then you bring it back to these children that are watching this played out, and they're yelling at the screen, "Lies! Those are lies!" Yeah. And then you also go into the totally made up persona that Teddy Roosevelt built for himself. Right. Which, yeah, I'm guessing the majority of people in this country have no idea that was fake. Yeah. And yet it's couched in this warm, loving, embrace of Cuba, as it is, that also, frankly, I think the majority of people in this country, prior to seeing this film, would not know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Like, so on the topic of public opinion, one thing that I hope people will watch and gain from this film is the dichotomy of, you know, we look at Cuba as this country that's stood still in time. They still have these old time cars, and yet they're more aware of what's going on and the lies of the past than a lot of people in the U.S. who we have all these freedoms and all this information at our fingertips. Yeah. But a lot of people just don't make the effort to search for the truth behind all of these things.
Well, the thing is that Cuba is essentially just a case study in this film, because Cuba is one of the, it's a very brutal word, of the backyards of an empire. You know, it's like, you know, the Egyptian Empire, first of this kind of model 7,000 years ago, had the Upper Nile, which is now called the Sudan, as the backyard. They took workforce, slaves, and resources from there, shipped it down the Nile and created, you know, the pyramids and that. And so every empire, and the Europeans had, you know, over centuries, or and still have Africa as the as the kind of continent that sends wealth, and then we create this like perverted, you know, we Europeans create this perverted narrative that Africa is poor and we have to help it, while we just suck out wealth, you know, in unbelievable, you know, amounts, you know. So it's so, and of course, and the backyard, quote unquote, of the United States when it became a superpower as it today was first the Caribbean and the Spanish, ex-Spanish, you know, owned colonies, and now it's in some way, as in, you know, most people will agree in this country, it's more or less over the planet, you know. It's like resources come here from everywhere, and it's not like it's nothing new anyway. It's not, you don't need Hubert or a film called Epicentro to know that. We all know that, but what a film can provide is, and that's something you just said, John, a very, very important word is experience. So there's this French writer Diderot said that human beings don't learn through information or facts. We only learn through experience, and therefore it has to be the task of art to provide the experience. So a good novel gives you an experience, or gives you a life experience. A good film gives you a life experience. So that's what I'm trying to create with cinema, which is giving you the experience of having been quote unquote, in Havana for 2 hours, and having met these amazing young humans that I call young prophets, who are the children in the film, and they are experiencing with us, or we experience through them, what is cinema, what is fake, what is not, what is an actor, what is a non-actor, what is fiction, what is documentary. And it's so hard. It's like what I said before, like this, the Edison, the Thomas Edison, made films 1 minute long that showed executions of poor Cubans by Spaniards. Those films are so amazing, and I saw them in archives, Library of Congress in Washington have these archives, and I was like, it's jaw-dropping, this. And then it turned out that they were all acted. It was just enacted executions. But over a century, these pictures have been distributed in hundreds or thousands of documentaries, shows, as this is the image of the Spanish-American War. The ships that explode in a bathtub in New Jersey are the archive of the Spanish-American War. Mm-hmm. The Spanish fleet sinking. It's paper. It's fake. It's a model. It's like, as long as an arm, mm-hmm. with cigar smoke. It's just mind-boggling. It's so amazing. And even me searching these archives, I was looking at them. I was like, of course they're extremely out of focus, and it's old and shaky, and sometimes too fast, sometimes too slow. But it was the first special effects. It was the first version of cinema as propaganda, cinema as special effects. And everything that followed is called Star Wars, and the Star Wars is just
exactly.
I mean, Star Wars is just a.
So I'm saying we're using the same tools. We're using the same tools and the same. So.
And the original Star Wars was made in a bathtub in New Jersey, and that's part of Epicentro.
Yeah. So. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the idea, and I want to wrap up this way, about the surprises with that. Even a veteran filmmaker like yourself can have. And, you talk about that where the discovery of what you're going to think, well, this is archival footage, and you go, in truth, it is not archival footage. And yet we've accepted it because several generations later, we just don't know. But I want to talk about the filming that you did in Cuba. Mm. And briefly, because we do want to wrap up, but talk about the surprises that you had, were they with, a couple of the children, the prophets, as you say, the narrators, as they perform within the function they perform in the film, but were there surprises along there that then kind of made the film for you?
Right. Well, just a word: the kids are not performing; they are themselves.
The service of being the narrator, right. In terms of
just not to confuse that, they're really themselves, and there's nothing, not an inch of it is enacted or so. But I showed, for example, what it means directing a documentary is, of course, interfering somehow in people's lives. If I say, hey, Angela, can you sit here a little bit sideways? I'm going to film you and take off your hat, for example. That is already interfering in your reality, and that is called directing documentary. So I push this boundary sometimes in a way that I am also very much part of the reality that I'm filming. So for example, we screened those films that are 120 years old from Edison to children in schools in Havana to see how they are reacting on them. And of course, we, the film team, screened those films. It's not like we didn't just walk into a school and by chance somebody showed Edison's movies. That is a part of directing the documentary. But then what comes out of it, and how people react, and how kids are talking about it, how kids are slowly realizing with us as the audience what is fake news that is 120 years old. And I don't want to say fake news. It's just some other... Should be some other word.
Let me jump in and just say again. This is a documentary that is surprising and artistic on multiple levels. Again, the title is Epicentro. It screens in the World Cinema Documentary Competition, and we've been talking with the director Hubert Sauper. It's been wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for being again in Sundance. I was here with another film a few years ago. We come as friends.
Yes. The Festival Daily Buzz is brought to you in partnership with Films Gone Wild. You can find more info at filmsgonewild.com.
Listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk teammate, Angela Tabora. And this segment is going to be about the Sundance film Spaceship Earth, which is in the U.S. documentary competition. We have our director, Matt Wolf, and with him are two subjects from the film, Catherine Gray and Mark Nelson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks Great for having us.
Thank you.
All right, yes. Matt, tell us what this film is about.
This is a film about a group of people who did projects around the world, and they found their ultimate expression in something called Biosphere 2, an enormous glass pyramid in the Arizona desert that had a miniature replica of Earth's ecosystem. And in 1991, 8 so-called Biospherians went to live inside, hermetically sealed, for 2 years. A lot of people have forgotten about the project, but my film Spaceship Earth really reappraises this story and thinks about its contemporary relevance today.
Yes, and peels back some layers of the onion as well. Let's start with our subjects. This was your life, and when a filmmaker like Matt comes around and says, you know something, I want to do a portrait of this thing that was your life. What are your thoughts?
Well, it was really exciting because this is 50 years. It's like, 900 hours of archival, footage or something like that. It's a big, it's a complex life, and Mark Nelson and I and our colleagues are very aware of the complexity of the story, and to be able and ambitious enough to tell such a complex story in a very clear narrative way is really thrilling. So it's great to work with Matt and Stacey Reese, the producer, and all of that, because the biosphere itself is a story of system science, which in essence is complex, and it's always been the challenge to communicate that in a clear way, and I'm really excited that you did it, Matt. That's what I feel.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what is also fascinating about the film is that there's such a balance between the hope of the projects that you guys did and then going into Biosphere, and then the complexities as we're characterizing them, which is what really happened. There are various reports what could be believed, and I think it was wonderfully done in that you took us back to that time, and so therefore when the reveals happen, then we are able to kind of experience them in a concentrated way, the way people were at the time. Talk about really quickly, Matt, about your process about editing to get that. So when those reveals happened again, like I said, you were bringing this along properly.
Yeah, I mean, I think this film is comprised basically entirely of archival footage. I think what was so remarkable is that this group of people documented their experience for half a century, including one of the Biospherians who filmed it inside. So, I think part of the reason it feels present tense is that you're seeing it from a personal point of view of our characters. And in terms of organizing the complexity of the narrative across all these different time periods and projects, our goal was really to do that through the point of view of people and individual characters, so that this wasn't replicating the news reports at the time, which I think really flattened the story and got it wrong.
Yeah, and on the topic of the people, of the subjects of this story, I'd love to talk to you guys about this idea of communal living, which was obviously had a big boost in the 60s, but you took it with a twist. You wanted longevity, so you're like, we're going to live communally, but we don't want to do drugs. We want longevity in this. When you're traveling around on the boat as nomads, you're not, you think of yourselves as a corporation. You're a business. You're not just traveling around haphazardly. Did I get that right? Is that, how is that mindset with a twist?
It is a complex story, but one of the magics I think that kept our extended group together and focused on ever more daunting and daring challenges is that we had really three pillars. One is we wanted to be self-supporting, self-financed. So we're always trying to make our projects, even as daring and in, you know, ventures into the unknown, enterprises, businesses. And we wanted to do ecological science, and it, as Catherine was saying, at a systems level. You know, we're not, you know, not necessarily in there with microscopes, although we have plenty of those people at Biosphere 2, et cetera. And we wanted to combine it with theater, because we wanted to live balanced lives. Mm-hmm. And I what I really loved mm-hmm. about the what Matt did with the footage was convey also some of the excitement and fun. Mm-hmm. It's not like we, you know, suffered. I didn't suffer being inside Biosphere 2 for 2 years. It was awesome. It was awesome even when it was terrible and really difficult, you know, because we were doing something that really needed to be done. So for me also, this is the perfect time for Spaceship Earth. And of course, you know, that's an homage to Bucky Fuller. And Biosphere 2 is Spaceship Earth, but Planet Earth is Spaceship Earth. And just like we were really madly trying to make Biosphere 2 work, we're trying to make Planet Earth remain habitable and beautiful and fulfilling for its people.
Mark was inside for 2 years, as you saw. So he was called a Biospherian, but actually all of us, all the species, humans and everybody else, including the fungi and the microorganism in our gut, and that's every, all of us are Biospherians.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thought that I had watching this is that when you're subjects in a film like this, and sometimes there is an element of, you know, we've been waiting for someone to tell this story the correct way, because we know what happened, and you know, and as Matt said, sometimes just news reports and whatever can flatten, can misrepresent, cannot tell a full story. So was there a little sense of relief in that way from the two of you with this? So you go, okay, finally we can really get a full portrait of what we know. What happened?
Well, I mean, I have been telling the story. Catherine's been telling. We've been telling the story. I published a book 2 years ago, which was 25 years of digestion, and a little plug, pushing our limits, insights from Biosphere 2. But that's going to reach a few thousand people. I mean, what's really exciting is such a major endeavor, and you know, it was the quality, our trust in both Matt and Stacey Reese, the primary producer. Yeah, these are people who can get the story, and for us, you know, we'll see who winds up buying Spaceship Earth, that it's going to reach, as Biosphere 2 did in its early days, it's going to reach hundreds of millions of people. This is really exciting.
Yeah, you know, for me, this sense of urgency, we felt the urgency to study the biosphere in 1980, and we had the Planet Earth Conference, the state of the planet. We were talking about climate change. James D. Hayes was one of the great climate scientists and historians. And all I've felt since then is a sense of urgency, and that we put the biosphere together. It was taken over, yes, but it was built. University of Arizona is running it. They're starting to really use it more for experimental science. Like, this is a biosphere. Let's understand it. And so this tremendous fire in the belly, I mean, and that's what I've been feeling all this time. This story has to be told, because to me, having lived it also, but slightly removed looking at it as a dramaturg, it's a narrative that is inspiring. It's like being a filmmaker in a sense. Independent film is about having a fire in your belly. You're going to tell that story no matter what anyone says. You're going to get it done, and you know, you're going to sell it now, you're going to sell it after the fact. It's a collaborative venture, filmmaking, and you may continue with those same people, you may not, but that's the story I wanted to get out, that you feel that fire in the belly for whatever it is, and it's at the state of the planet where you have to have, like, millions of Greta Thunbergs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whatever you can do, do it.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for your passion, and thank you for bringing up this sense of urgency, because I wasn't ready for the twist at the end of the film when we see our good friend Steve Bannon
And the
is he our good friend?
Sorry, the audience couldn't see my sarcasm in my eyes, but just the irony of him saying, "Oh, we're going to study the Earth's effects back then," and then seeing what has come of his policies since then. So thank you for bringing up that sense of urgency and Matt for adding that to the film.
Go
just
to
for
the Biosphere 2 as it is, and you see the scale. It, you can go there. Mm-hmm. You can visit it. Mm-hmm. See it.
I also would love for you, all three of you to talk about the timeliness of the film now, because you know right now we're in a situation where or a time where obviously, as you talk with Greta and other people talking about the climate change and crises and there, but we also have a proliferation of environmentally focused film festivals. We have things like EarthX in Dallas, which has like a 2-week, like huge, you know, event that brings people from all across the country to talk about things that you guys were talking about and putting into action in the 90s. So talk about that, about you going, okay, you know, this seems right. This seems perfect that we're delivering this at this time. Matt, start with you.
For me, you know, I understood this story to be much larger than Biosphere 2, and what appealed to me is that I encountered a group of people who quite literally reimagined the world, and that is the kind of energy and fire in the belly Kathleen is talking about that we need right now, is people reimagining the world. And as I was making the film, I recognized that part of the model that these people used is small groups. This idea that if a small group of people who share a common goal bring together their varied skills, they can accomplish magnificent things. And yes, Biosphere 2 was taken over. This is a film that's about human achievement, both the possibilities and the limitations of it, but this kernel and spirit of wanting to reimagine the world is something that this group of people did over half a century and that a new generation needs to grasp as well.
Change isn't going to come from the top down. It comes from multi vectors, from the individuals.
Well, now here's the final question I have, as we're about to wrap up this segment. But whenever you are part of a film like this, whether you're the filmmaker or the subjects, oftentimes then you become the de facto spokespeople, because as the film makes its tour with film festivals or, you know, or whatever distribution it gets, then you're going to be asked to talk about the film and about the things that you have been talking about since the 1990s and before that. Are all three of you ready for that?
Oh, I'm ready.
Ready, willing, and able.
All right. More than ready. We're doing it now.
All right, fantastic. Again, the film is Spaceship Earth, screening in the U.S. Documentary Competition at Sundance. We've had with us the director of the film, Matt Wolf, and we've had our subjects as well, Kathleen Gray and Mark Nelson. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for having us. Thank you so much.
The Festival Daily Buzz is brought to you in partnership with Bitch Talk Podcast. You can find more info at bitchtalkpodcast.com.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and kcpw.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, and we're going to do a special segment on the show right now. We have Rob Yang with us, and I could go over just a laundry list of credits with Rob, but everybody I talk to goes, "Dude from Secession? What? That guy? And Living With Yourself? Holy crap." But here's why we have Rob on the show, because this is your first Sundance.
Well, I have to correct that a little bit.
Okay.
I came here during a blizzard, I think it was 2017.
Okay.
And so that was actually my first.
You came in Sundance in a blizzard.
Like, yeah, so it was
like a Coen Brothers movie, like you just rolled into town and what, weren't expecting to be here?
I basically came in on this big snowdrift, and it was a whiteout, and so I actually didn't even get to really see Sundance.
Okay. I know we were introduced because you came in to do Sundance. Let's say that. All right. Yeah.
So, yes.
And that is a rare experience. Like, it's been 20 years since I did my first Sundance, and so I was anxious to have you on the show to talk about what the experience has been so far and what your thoughts were like. You know, coming in, what was the idea to come in?
Well, I came here this time just to have fun, enjoy myself, and meet people. I was an actor in the Directors Lab. that Sundance runs back in 2014. And so I just like being around filmmakers and people doing things. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about being here is I've found just walking down the street or just ducking into some party here and there that you end up just running into all these people that you haven't seen in a while or people that you worked with.
You can't help it.
Yeah.
I mean, especially for someone like yourself who's been on countless sets and, you know, and you're just going to find either someone that then moved into their own director role after they've been, you know, either writing or, you know, or doing other jobs on set. So then they've moved up to that level. Or you have, you know, the people that the representatives and other things like that. Tell me what you did yesterday. What happened yesterday?
Yesterday. Yesterday I went out. I tried to see the Quibi thing that they were having at 9:30. And I thought I was just going to come down and get in line, see that, or try to get in, and then go back up to the house to get breakfast. But it ended up just being the entire day out. So let's see. I went to get coffee, ran into somebody that I was trying to connect with. I actually texted her. She's got a film that she's producing. And she happened to be like 5 feet from me with her back to me, but she was in a meeting. So like, you know, like 20 minutes later, she turned around as I was leaving. So I ran into her, and then somebody else texted to get drinks and some food. And so I went to some HBO party up down the street and had drinks there. It felt like being in a club during the middle of the day, and that was it was nicely fueled without any real breakfast or, you know, it's so the day kind of just went on that way, and then so just going from one group to another, and it was pretty nice.
And I know I think it's tomorrow you're going to be at the Bentonville Film Festival's Film Fatales event, and you're going to be doing that.
Ooh.
But now you're although we've seen you in a ton of stuff as an actor, you're also a writer, correct?
I am. I like to write. I did a lot of comedy stuff. I have a lot of people who when they see me, they're surprised that I smile. You know, and so I think I've got this whole comedy side. I used to do comedy improv and sketch. And that's when I started acting a while back in New York. So I have been writing for a long time.
But that's, you know, I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this segment with you and have you on, because you're not alone in the idea of people coming up to Sundance, not because they have a project either in Sundance or Slam Dance that year, but because, you know, they either know there's a couple things on the horizon, so they may be coming back for reals, so to speak, or they're literally here to network. You know, I had a producer friend of mine who had a film that I worked with at South by Southwest last year, and that's all he was here. He wasn't here to see movies. You know, he was here to meet distributors and, you know, and work his network. Let's talk about that and kind of what, you know, in a perfect world, we kind of know what the perfect world would be, but kind of talk about what the perfect world would be for you out of this experience.
I guess it would just be meeting people in this casual environment to actually get to know them, and you know, I've got this a couple projects that I want to develop, and so ideally it would be nice to connect with people who have a similar sense of humor or get the thing that I'm trying to do, and then coming out of this just actually getting to know them as a person to see if we're like-minded people and that we can do something together. I think that would be a nice thing to come out of this and then go back home to LA and then just make some new friends. I think it's exponential when you work on something and then you work on the next thing and you meet people. It becomes to me it feels like more of a community, and it gets me closer to you know, there's certain things that I want to say and put out there, so it's nice to it'd be nice to meet people who encourage that and seeing other people who've done it themselves and then
well, you know, and it's interesting you say that, because I work with a lot of film festivals across the country, and I'm one of my big kind of campaigns is what concretely film festivals can do for filmmakers. And of course the idea usually is like, well, give me the check to make the next movie, but that's never, no filmmaker ever says that. they always say what you just said, which is pretty much, put me in the room. Put me in the room with other people that I may work with, mm-hmm. that they may hire me, I may hire them, they may be a resource for me, I may be a resource for them. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a universal with filmmakers, yes?
Yeah, I mean, it's been so tied to letting people get to know me instead of having some sort of like little wall up, you know, like trying to send my representative out to meet everyone. So I think creating things is part of that. So I really love meeting people, and just, you know, the getting to know them in that capacity where you can really have real talk. I seem to have this inability to really not get into the deep stuff when it's one-on-one with people.
And people probably appreciate that.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
If it's too many people, then I become like, you know, a bit of a wine or scotch machine in the corner. It's just like self-dispensing. So.
Well, listen, you know, again, we've been talking with Rob Yang, who you've seen in a lot of stuff on TV and stuff, but certainly now, because you're a little bit of a roll, you have been recently. And we will certainly see you back in the future, I'm sure, with your other projects. Thanks for being on the show,
awesome.
Rob.
Thanks, John.
And that's a wrap on today's edition of the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This show is made possible with partnerships with the Slam Dance Film Festival, GoTo Productions, and KCPW Radio. In-kind donations are provided by Pro Bar, Keto's Brewing, and The Market, Park City. Our audio producer is Charlene Goto. Social media help was provided by Shoshana Howard. And assisting us in production are Chris Gardner and Brian Silverman. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Thanks for listening.